As we go forward in our study in the 17th chapter, you may remember from the class last week, chapter 16 and in verse 19, it says the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. And then it sort of describes that, and these huge hailstones. Judgment was coming against Babylon. And so that's where things left off last week, where it talks about they're split into three parts. There's an interesting statement in chapter 14 and verse 8 and chapter 18 and verse 8 that sort of gives maybe a flavor as to why that terminology is used. But it's talking about this judgment sort of from every direction and other things that we might note. But notice it talks about Babylon. And I think last week that you talked some about that, that Babylon is pictured in the Old Testament certainly as a nation that the Israelites or the Jewish people were captive in and known as sort of the enemy of God. And, you know, she loved her power and her might. The book of Habakkuk talks about God bringing the Chaldeans, the Babylonians in, and was going to bring chastisement and judgment against Judah for her unfaithfulness or sinfulness. This is after the death of Josiah. And describes her there, and Habakkuk says, how can you allow someone more wicked than we are to do this? And God says, well, I'll bring them into judgment. I'll take care of that into things. But they have already chosen their wickedness and the direction that they would go. And I'm going to use that as an instrument to accomplish what I need to accomplish. Now, in Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5, I believe it is, there it talks about God used Assyria as the rod of his anger. And I stole an illustration from a guy many years ago, and I've used it here a few times. God didn't make the Assyrians mean and evil. God didn't make the Babylonians mean and evil. They made choices as a people, and that's their character. But God was able to use them as they were to accomplish his end or his means. And the illustration is this, and you've heard me use it probably several times. If I had an ice box that had all my favorite food in it, and I didn't want to share with Louie, I might get a big Doberman pincher. Matter of fact, I might get a pair of them and chain them out around the front of that refrigerator. Now, I didn't make the Doberman mean. That's who he is. But I can use him to accomplish my purpose, to keep Louie out of my freezer. Oh, yeah. Louie says, I can still get in there. So that's our little visual debate here. And so with these nations, God didn't make them mean. They chose that. They went that direction. But God in his wisdom and his might and his providence and power could use that to accomplish his ends and his means. And so that's helpful. Because what we find is that Rome is laying waste, so to say, the kingdom of God. He is mean and blasphemous and full of abominations, and is trampling the saints, just like Daniel 7 said would happen during the period of the Roman Empire. God didn't make Rome mean. He brought kings up and he allowed things to happen, and I certainly don't even remotely claim to understand how all that works. I don't. But God did, and he used them to test the faith of those in his kingdom. Will they walk with me, stay with me? Will this kingdom stand? And God says, it will. And I'll bring it about. And again, we're not going to go back to Daniel 7. I've alluded to that. Carl has. It is just, I believe, the book of Revelation is an expansion of what's in Daniel chapter 7. But we find in this particular chapter, it's going to talk to us about Babylon. Here it's talking about the enemy of God. And so what I'd like to do at this point, I'm going to let you fill in the blanks. We're going to do what Carl has been doing oftentimes. And let's see, what all is in this chapter? Who are the characters and the things that you see in this chapter? So we'll just start off. What do you see here in chapter 17? Okay, there is one of the angels with one of the bowls, the seven bowls. Now, which one of those seven is it? Your question. It doesn't tell you. It just says one of them. And these bowls were the wrath of God being poured out. And so in the midst of that wrath being poured out of that, if you would, here is a picture that we'll see unfold. What else do you see besides the angel with the bowl? I'm sorry.
The harlot.
Okay, you see the harlot. Is she described here in any other way? She's the harlot or prostitute, depending on the translation.
Scarlet.
Okay, she has scarlet. She wears scarlet there.
A golden goblet full of the obscenities.
Okay, that describes her immorality, I guess you would say. Who else is in here?
Scarlet beast.
Okay, she's on a scarlet beast. I'm not asking the question well. Who else in this chapter, or what else in this chapter, is talking about the same woman and using different descriptive terms? That's that. That's the question I'm after. What I was just talking about a moment ago, really. How about Babylon? That's what I'm at. Babylon the Great, as we go down through here. We're going to see the great city as we go down through here. And so as we go down through this chapter, some of these different terms are going to pop up, descriptive of who this woman is. As you go down to verse 6, how else does it describe this woman? There's some of her characteristics here. Okay. She is drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. Okay. So that's a part of the description of this woman, as has already been mentioned. There are other descriptions here. But that's important. What else do you see in verse 1? What's going to happen to this harlot in verse 1?
Judgment.
Judgment is coming against her. And again, at verse 6, it describes she is drunk with the blood of God's servants, the saints, as he describes here, and the witnesses of Jesus. And so I think back in chapter 6, verses 9, 10, and 11, you remember the souls of those at the altar in heaven? They said, how long, O holy and true, what? Before thou dost judge and avenge those upon the earth. You remember anything after that he said? Somebody said it. Wait, okay. Wait for a little while until what? Let's look back here. Chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. And I'm just familiar with those verses because they've always stood out in my mind. So that's sort of cheating, you know. If you ask me things I'm familiar with, I can tell you. Ask me something else, and so I'll have to look it up. So, in verse 9, as the fifth seal was broken, underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God, because of the testimony which they had maintained. Is that similar to the blood of the saints over in chapter 17, talking about the same kind of people? And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, wilt thou refrain from judging and avenging, carrying out righteous judgment, carrying out vengeance, avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Does that sound like sort of familiar things like we just read in chapter 17? And there was given to each one of them a white robe. And we see in chapter 7, you know, they're victorious, these folks. These folks that have submitted to death and faithfulness to God are now victorious. They're in white robes celebrating. Chapter 7 talks some about that. And they were told that they should rest for a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, should be completed. So it says, here's what has happened, and here's what's going to come. And so there are a number that have been persecuted. They have faced the persecution that's going on. And he's saying, wait a little while, there's more to come. Now, I think that helps our chapter a little bit because we're going to get down to a question here later on that has been one of the more perplexing phrases, statements in the book of Revelation, I think most would consider. And so we'll get there in a little bit, but I think that's helpful to me. Back to this woman and descriptive of her. In verse 1, where does she sit? Okay, she sits on many waters. Now, Carl has talked some about that. Does anybody remember possibly what that might be talking about? It's just a fish. Remember, this is all figurative.
The surrounding area of Rome is water, if you look at it.
Okay.
Down to the south, the east, and the west is all water.
Okay.
Is how Italy is into the Mediterranean.
That would certainly be true. Okay.
In verse 15, it actually says.
It says. The chapter tells us. And this is Old Testament terminology. We'll not go back and try to chase that down. And what it depicts in the Old Testament prophets, I think a number of times, and I first saw this many years ago from a guy named Homer Haley had written on this and put a number of passages through it to demonstrate. It's just talking about the masses of humanity, of people. And sometimes the description goes with it, the idea of sea. Here the sea is just constantly churning. That's the way humanity is. And so I'm not fully sure why that terminology was used, but it is very clear that it is. And for our immediate purpose, as you get down through to verse 15, he tells us, and he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits, that's verse 1, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And so that's the same kind of thing that other biblical passages, I think, relate to that. And so we see that. And then also, down in verse 18, and this is, to me, a critical verse to help me in the understanding of the book of Revelation in view of some other interpretations that have been taken. And what does verse 18 tell you? And who is verse 18 describing? Okay, it describes the woman. She is the great city. What great city? That she reigns over the kings of the earth. When this is written, I just cannot see it talking about anyone but Rome. There are folks who take a position, and I appreciate that, and I've read a little in the past about that, that the book of Revelation is talking about an earlier date and the destruction of Jerusalem and some things of that nature. And I've looked and weighed some of those things and understand arguments some years by. But this is one of the verses that said, now, that just does not fit any way, shape, or form. And so just notice that. And by the way, who is this? Who is this great city? Rome. The city of Rome. And so he tells us in the chapter. Now, as we go on down through here looking at our terms, let's see. Sure.
People that view this as still to come, right? That it's not talking about history or historical events. Do they think that there's going to be like a one world power, and that's what this is talking about?
Oftentimes, I think that's the case. When I was first a Christian, I decided that I needed to find out about premillennialism, so I'm going to go get me a book and read up on it. And that's how I went to this bookstore, and I found this book, and it had 47 dozen aspects and positions on premillennialism. It was, a huge spectrum. The point being is when you start reading into this and when you start making up stories, once the end and the unification of that, when I'm with my grandkids, when my boys were growing up, I made up stories at bedtime. They were adventure stories of Giorgio. I don't know where I came up with that. And so now my grandkids are saying, especially Gloria, oh, will you tell us Giorgio so we go to bed? Now, when I make up a story, I'm not very good at it. I don't have to be. They're not critiquing my grammar, okay? But where does that story go?
Wherever you want it to go.
Wherever I want it to go. When you come to God's Word and say, oh, that's interesting. Now, let me tell you all about this. Where does it go? Wherever you want it to go. And so, to answer your question, there are lots of people who say lots of different things in different directions. But yeah, the one world power, I think, was probably it. Again, I'm not well studied on that, but I think that is the case. Okay.
Within the vision and the angel's interpretation of that vision, so there's clear insight is what God is revealing to us.
Okay.
On his mind, there's a clear past and a very clear present and a very clear future at the time of this vision to take this and shove it backward, even just a few years, 30, 40 years, to say destruction of Jerusalem does not fit. And certainly to extract and say none of this has happened, it does not fit because
right. That
makes the angel a liar when he's talking about the things that are actually present. And then later in the future, this is going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. There are some times in language where you can use the past, future, and so forth in a contextual way, like it's already happened. It hadn't really happened. And so you find that. And so they would probably try to twist and tweak. But what you're saying, I think, is exactly on spot here with this. Now what happens, let's see, At the end of verse 6, what is the last statement of verse 6? What's the last sentence of verse 6? When I saw her, I wondered greatly. What's the next verse say? Why are you amazed? And what's going to happen starting in verse 7? I'm going to tell you the mystery. So back to the very point Tommy's making here is John saying, wow, whoo. And he says, why are you wondering? Let me tell you, here's what's going on. And the very last verse of this chapter, this is talking about the great city Rome that rules the world and the trade and all that's going on. And so, you know, like I say, if you stay close to the context, and again, I appreciate the way Carl has done that. My temptation, and his also, is in scheduling a teaching program, the last book that I try to teach in that schedule is the book of Revelation. So that we go through all the Old Testament beforehand, looking at the prophets in a different language, especially the apocalyptic language of the Old Testament, we get a feel for that. And you get very familiar with that. What happens is you read through the book of Revelation. I've heard that before. Oh, that sounds familiar. Oh, yeah, here. There's so many of these Old Testament passages, as you see, judgment and all that's used. And so I was astounded as a young Christian. I moved out to a town in the central state of Washington with another guy to try to start a new work there. That was my first undertaking. And there was a guy there, an older guy in a small congregation who leaned, I'll just say, a little left into their teachings. He said, we shouldn't study the Old Testament. We're under the New Covenant. They never studied. He never studied. He didn't think, that's not the covenant you're under. Don't mess around with that. You just study the New Testament. Are you serious? How in the world can you ever fully understand the New Testament if you don't understand the foundation, the background, the scheme, the purpose, the terminology, God's unfolding of all this? You know, who's Abraham? Well, you can get some glimpses, but if you want to know, you got to go back to the Old Testament and look. The same thing with this apocalyptic language. One of the many blessings of studying through the prophets is that you get some exposure to how God speaks with this kind of language. So as we've come to the book of Revelation, yeah, we see that over and over again. Carl has resisted the temptation to go back and say, okay, look here. And once in a while I cheat and I say, hey, what about this? and I love it. So anyway, for our good and for your present and future considerations, as you study through the Old Testament next time, and as you're going through the book of Ezekiel or going through Zechariah or Isaiah, you'll say, I've heard this language before. And maybe because you've studied those books before, but maybe, oh, that was over in the book of Revelation, something very similar to that. So just drive a peg there for your future studies. All right, so we've got many waters. That's the multitudes of people, the great city Rome's involved in the midst of that. Down in verse 10, who else is described in this chapter?
Five kings.
Okay. In verse 10, there are seven kings. Okay. And then also in verse 12, let's see. What do you have in verse 12? Okay. And what are they? They are ten kings, so you've got the seven horns and you got the ten horns, which are ten kings in verse 12.
But they haven't risen to power yet.
Okay, but you've got ten kings there, and in verse 10 you've got seven kings. So there's a distinction here, and then an eighth, which we'll talk about in a minute. Okay, now and so who are these kings? Well. In verse 2, how does it describe these kings in verse 2?
In my book, it says they have had immoral relations with women.
Okay. So they are associated with this harlot. These kings have taken up, if you would, a relationship. The kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And so these kings, what we see as this chapter unfolds, I believe, are giving allegiance to Rome. And it's just talking about these surrounding subsets in the Roman Empire. They're giving their allegiance and their power and all to Rome.
So basically, they're buying what Rome's selling.
Yeah, they're buying what Rome's selling. But what we find at the end of the chapter, since I'm approaching it this way, is in verse 16. And the 10 horns which you saw, which were 10 kings there a moment ago, and the beast, these will hate the harlot. So what happens in the end result? These kings that are early on associated with her are going to turn back around and eat her alive before it's done. And so they're, historically I understand, you know, as things unfold, that happens. They get discord and disharmony in the nation. And what Jesus say, if a kingdom is divided. And so I think that's the picture. These folks are on board with her because she's got the power, the prestige. They're imbibing in her immorality, her drunkenness on her own power. And they give Rome their support and power in persecuting the saints as well. But what happens in the end is they turn against her. Now, there's another thing here. There are some other kings, and this is one of the hardest parts of this particular text, is, let's see, down in verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss to go to destruction, and those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. Now verse 10, verse 9 is sort of a subset here. Verse 10, and they are seven kings, five have fallen, one is, and the other has yet to come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. And the beast which was and is not is himself also the eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. So here, this is not talking about the 10 satellite kings, if you would. This is talking about the power that's in Rome and that struggle. Now, I'm going to go ahead and mention this now and not develop it later. There's a guy by the name of Jim McGuigan who has written a commentary on the book Revelation, and I like much of what he has to say. Carl has mentioned him, I think, early on in the course of these studies. I like a lot of what he has to say. But he tries to take this section and make a literal application to numbering the kings in Rome and some different things. The problem with that is you have to do some manipulating of things to make them fit in this picture square. When I was young, trying to put puzzles together, I was prone to do that. I would try to put the wrong puzzle piece in there. And once you do it for 3 years old and it won't quite fit. Yeah, that's right. That's my girl. You don't look for another piece, you get a bigger hammer. Okay. It seems to me, and I think this is correct, that was, is not, is about to come is talking about this persecuting power of Rome. The seven kings is not talking about seven literal kings, but it is talking about this kingdom, these kings, and the persecuting power. As this is written and as things are coming about, this persecution has laid low for a little bit, but it's about ready to be revived again. And so that's what I really understand the thrust of this language is. And I think that's the same direction that the notes that Carl has been using takes and other things I've read. And I really, I'll just be honest with you, I've really been tempted to take the literal kings of Rome and put that in here. And I can understand, and McGuigan takes that position, but I find it more consistent. Now, the eighth that he puts here, McGuigan says that's the number of the resurrection. And so here this thing, these seven kings have been, it's not, but it's about ready to raise. You have 7 days. What happened on the eighth day?
Christ arose.
And so that's the direction he takes. Whether that's so or not, I like it. But I think it's the purpose here. And the beast, Babylon, is against the saints of God. The persecution is about ready to get thick again. Okay? So anyway, Rachel.
I think it's interesting, like you said, like most of this is But in verse 9, when it says the seven heads of the seven mountains on which the woman is seated, it's well known that Rome was built on seven hills. That's like common, you know, historical knowledge.
So it is.
That's kind of interesting because it's like, okay, if you need more information about who this really is, what it's talking about, here's seven hills, seven mountains that it's seated on, which is kind of an interesting.
No, I think that's exactly right. And also, the thing you can do with that is seven is just being used as a completeness, mountains and the kingdoms, and so here's complete power. But I agree. Historically, Rome was founded on seven hills, and that is widely documented, written about, so there's no question about that. But I don't have a problem putting that physical, just like the last statement in here. This city that I am talking about, let it not be mistaken. She rules the whole world. She's the city that sits on these hills. And so I appreciate that. I think that's appropriate. Yep. Good question. Other comments or questions there?
Time factor seems to be clearly illustrated here, that in the life of one king who is yet to be overthrown and in the life of another king who is yet to come, that these things are going to happen. So there's a small time frame that's established here.
Okay.
We can take comfort in that. No, it's we're not.
That's right. Since I'm so far in for a penny, in for a pound, not just going through the chapter verse by verse, hopefully it'll be helpful to us. But what you see in this is down in verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up. Where does he come from?
The abyss.
Okay, the abyss. Have we heard anything about that in the book of Revelation? Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me turn back chapters 9 and verse 1. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven, which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the abyss, or the bottomless pit, was given to him. And then out of this comes all this filth and stuff. And so we're talking about that which is evil. We're talking about the devil's domain, if you would. And in chapter 11, in verse 7, it says, and when they had finished their testimony, here's the two witnesses, and their persecution and oppression is great. And when these two witnesses are killed, the earth dwellers rejoice once they have borne their witness. But then what happens to the two witnesses? Do you remember? They're resurrected. Okay. But in the midst of that, if you notice here in chapter 11, verse 7, and when they had finished their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. So you see the same terminology. Here's the demonic source of this is the point. Now, let's go back and talk about Babylon, the harlot. There is more that we could probably say about some of those other things. Oh, I do want to look at one other thing first. Down in verse 14, and this is a sort of a key focal verse, I think, that impacts the whole book and this conflict that's going on. And what does it say? Verse 14. I need a reader for that. Who's got that handy? Rusty?
These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Those who are with him are called chosen and faithful.
Okay, so here's war. It's against the Lamb. But who's going to win?
The Lamb. The Lamb always wins.
Why? He's Lord of lords and King of kings. Now, is that new biblical terminology? No. The Father in the Old Testament is described now. He's God. He is the King. He sets above the kings of the earth. The Lord of lords, Jesus, the Lamb, is the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, chapter 5. He is the King of kings and Lord of lords. So he overcomes because of that. And what about those who are with him? How are they described in verse 14? Called, chosen, and faithful. Calling is used many times in the New Testament. Chosen, called and chosen is used many times. But here he adds with that, there's more to it. You got to continue to walk with the Lamb. Could I get somebody to read Revelation 14:4 for me? There's another one of those verses I love in this book. Who's got chapter 14 and verse 4? JJ?
Follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the land.
Okay, so here it's talking about God's servants, redeemed people, and they are committed to Christ. There's the imagery used in the New Testament of Christ and his church, the bride of Christ, and so forth. But where do these redeemed people go in 14:4? This is what I love about this verse.
Follow the Lamb.
Where?
Wherever he goes.
Okay, they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Now, as we look at our chapter 17, they're called chosen and faithful. Where the Lamb leads, they follow. Now, let's go back to verse 8 we were at a moment ago, and we talked about this beast comes up out of the abyss. Where is he going in verse 8? He's going to destruction. What does that tell you? Okay, his power is going to be manifest powerfully here. Persecution and the blood of the saints. But he's going to be judged. It's going to be brought to an end. That's not the final game. And so as you see that in here, that's important. Now, let's go back again where I started to go a moment ago. Who is this Babylon? What's the description? And what I want to suggest to you is that this is simply talking about Rome, and I think the chapter has demonstrated that, the last verse, as the city of Rome especially. But you notice there in verse 3, she has 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, pardon me, it was allergies for me. If you go back to chapter 13 and in verse 1, you remember there was a different lady described there. The radiant woman, everything that's good and pure and holy described in there. God's people is who's actually described. The remnant of Israel becoming God's people of the new covenant, these Jewish people. And the Christ came from that. So here's this beautiful, pure woman. What do we have in chapter 17? This abominable woman. Oftentimes in this book of Revelation, you see these contrasts. You see here's this kind of description. The other swing of things, it goes the other way and shows that. If you look at chapter 13 and verse 5, it's going to describe in verse 2 a dragon. Okay, and we find, as you drop on down to verse 5, and there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. So this period of persecution, and again, the blasphemies against God in verse 6. But as you back up to verse 1 where we were just a moment ago, the beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems. That's the kingly crown rather than a victory crown. And blasphemous names. So who was this beast associated with here? Do you remember?
Satan.
Okay, Satan. Verse 17, the dragon was enraged with the woman, with God's people. And the dragon brings up a beast out of the sea and a beast out of the earth in chapter 13. Described here in the same terminology with the 7 heads on his horns, with 10 horns and 7 heads. Same terminology we see again, I think, in chapter 14, and we're looking at in chapter 17. I made that complex and probably mucked up the water, but all I'm trying to show is this description of the dragon, the devil, as chapter 12 and 13 describe. And it's showing also that this harlot is of the same family or group, so to say. Now, do you remember what two aspects of the Roman Empire are described in chapter 13? The sea beast and an earth beast. What was the sea beast representative of? This would be a good thing to...
The military
military power. Right?
Okay, the military power, the physical authority and power of Rome itself. What about the earth beast? You get halfway down through the chapter here. You find in verse 11 another beast coming up out of the earth. Remember what that described? False religion. Okay. Now, it's talking still about Rome. It's just talking about different aspects of this Roman control and power. And as you look at chapter 17, what you find, I want to suggest, is just another tentacle or aspect of the Roman influence and power. And I jumped over, I was looking for this verse. But in chapter 12 and in verse 3, here's this radiant woman ready to have this baby to give birth in verse 2. And another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. So here's power. You see, here is the dragon. Chapter 13, you hear the dragon bringing up the sea beast. Here's the dragon bringing up the earth beast. They are described with these heads and horns in a similar way, showing their derivative of power. Who's behind this is the dragon. Now, in chapter 17, where does this harlot get her power? How is she described in chapter 17 in verse 3? She has 7 heads and 10 horns. You see that terminology linked to chapter 12, chapter 13 through here. So this is not like, okay, here's a new event. We're talking about a different book. No. It's going to describe a different aspect of Rome's influence and power here, her seductive power. Louis?
When I read verse 3, it talks about the beast and it had 7 heads.
Right.
Well,
she is on, the woman is sitting on the scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads, 10 horns. She is riding on that beast, Rome, and her power and her influence. So that's how those connect together. That's her mechanism. Now she was seductive. People bought in to what she has said. But by the way, you may or may not realize this, there are probably people in the world who would describe the United States in that way. I know there are. That our power and our wealth and they would consider our waywardness from God. Some Islamic folks, they would look at this description and say, that's the United States. This is the great demon, the dragon and evil. And so they would describe the United States. I think they missed it on from their perspective and everything. But you see this power. People want to get on board. I've heard it said many times, you know, we oftentimes don't have a lot of friends in the world. We try to buy that sometimes. But, you know, what happens when the money dries up? Yeah, it can tend to happen that way. But here's her influence and power, and people are lured by her. You remember back in chapter 13, we talked about the mark of the beast. Remember, this is a number of man. There was discrimination against the saints. And those folks that were serving the devil, there, the beast, they had a mark on their hand or on their forehead, just saying, look, here's who's we are. And we saw a contrast to that in the 7th chapter where God marked his own people. I know who my people are. So you've got this contract. The earth dwellers and the heavenly dwellers, if you would, the spiritual. Well, this wealth, this power, this influence of Rome impacts people. And people had to decide who they will serve. And I'd say that's the question we all have to figure out, especially in the midst of in our nation being in the mess that it is, upside down. Where is our allegiance? I mean, I love this country. I spent time in the military. I probably love our country in many ways as much as most. But my allegiance is to my Lord. And in this book, what you see is they had to figure out whose allegiance they would have. They would be aligned with the Lord or with the beast, with the devil. So decisions have to be made, okay? All right. Let's just stop here. Questions or comments? Anything in here? I think what maybe I'd like to do next, I may just go down through here and read this to try to pull this together. Okay. Questions or comments? about anything in there. I hope I haven't. Will, did you have a hand?
Can you elaborate a little bit on 16 and 17, how they will hate the harlot and make her desert of the naked and eat her flesh and burn her with fire?
Okay. Now, if you notice, Will's wanting to know about verse 16 and 17. Let's go into verse 17 for just a second. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose or his mind by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast. I want to pull that back to what we were talking about in Isaiah 10:5. O Assyria, the rod of my anger, or the Babylon. God used Babylon in the book of Habakkuk to accomplish his means. Now, how he does that exactly, I don't fully know. He allowed these satellite kings that were given power by Rome to have that. And so they help inflict persecution against the saints. But when God's got accomplished what he needs accomplished here, he says what's going to happen is these are going to turn against Rome. That's what I understand. And so in verse 16, the ten horns, which is introduced there back in verse 12, or talked about in verse 12, which you saw, and the beast, these will hate the harlot. The city of Rome, I think, is described in verse 18. And will make her desolate and naked, and will eat her flesh, and will burn her up with fire. Have you ever seen, you know, maybe movies or something where these beasts are animals or some creatures, they're fighting against somebody, and then after a while, what happens? They turn on each other. That's the picture I see here, yeah? Why Rome's in power, and we're giving it that power, but after a while, what happens is they start turning against Rome. And again, I'm not a historian, and I don't have the memory to remember all that history, but from what I have read from various sources and things, as Rome continues to unfold, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire would be one of those sources, is you see that these surrounding peoples that are on the fringes in Rome and are giving this power, after a while, when the kingdom becomes divided, they start turning on Rome itself, and it starts causing it to deteriorate and erode and break down over a period of time. Is there some other part of that you'd like me to comment on? That's my understanding of the direction of this.
Yeah, from the look of it, like Rome is, the city of Rome is overthrown, but then the beast still has power. They give their king to the beast.
Yeah, these kings are like, I'm just going to say like Herod or Pilate. We think of these guys, of these different nations around, the guys that have control. Those are not the best illustrations. But folks that have been sort of assimilated within Rome, it says that they are kings, but they don't have kingdoms. Let's see, where's that at in here? What verse is that in? Let's see. I suggest here.
Verse 12.
Okay, thank you. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, so they don't have a kingdom. But they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. When that hour's up, there's a period of time's up, they're given this authority by Rome, by the beast. Now, they're going to turn on Rome. Okay. Does that answer the question you had in mind? That may not be perfect, but that's the best I can do at the moment. Yeah. Other comments or questions? Great stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
It reminds me of Galatians 5:15 that admonishes us to be careful not to bite and devour one another lest we be consumed.
Okay.
By one another.
Okay.
And then it goes to talk about the works of the flesh below, where it's selfishness drives people to promote their own interests and not be respectful or mindful of others. And this is Satan's ways are always destructive. And so this kind of behavior is self-destructive. In the long term, it's going to fail because someone else is behaving that way and going to raise up as soon as they see an opportunity
okay.
to attack the weak, you know, the one who was powerful if there's a weakness. And that's the way it's been through all of history. And it, in God's wisdom, you know, it seems that he uses this pattern over and over again of wicked men who follow wicked ways to defeat wickedness that may be, harmful to God's people. But this is the way of the world. It's not surprising.
Okay, yeah.
It's self-destructive.
Yeah, James 3 talks about that's the wisdom of the world, not the wisdom from above. Very good. And the Old Testament, the wisdom literature talks some about that. There's one where an old king is replaced by a young king. He's real popular for a little bit, and all of a sudden he loses his popularity. They forget who he is. They go, that's the way of the world. But here they're turning against each other. That's a powerful point you made, Deborah. Thank you. Okay. again, notice chapter 16, verse 19, where we started, and Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. We've been talking about the pouring out of the bowls of wrath. So here, now it steps aside and says, okay, here's this wrath against Rome. Talks about that. She's described in chapter 17, verse 1, Babylon as the great harlot. Verse 5, and upon her forehead a name is written. Who she belonged to? She's Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, in verse 6, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. By the way, I saw the woman drunk. That just doesn't mean that she spilled the blood. But what happened is there became an excitement about that. I've mentioned it somewhere before, but I have a historical book by a fellow named of Eusebius, a church history. And he spends, if I remember right, a couple of chapters, many pages in there that I've read. He spends chapters describing the persecution that goes on at a later time. Now, Diocletian was around about 301, and there was about a two-year period where he said, we're going to obliterate Christianity. And they tortured people to try to get them to surrender scrolls of the New Testament books. They would move their army in around where people were meeting. They would burn the building down around them. He describes in there the persecutions, which I couldn't even start to express publicly. They are so heinous that these generals said, hey, you think you made them suffer and shame them? Watch this. And it became a competition. That's how Eusebius describes this. Frankly, I've grown up in a real peaceful, civil world. And that's hard for me to get my head around. If you've ever seen somebody that just sort of went out of their mind and were in a fist fight and was beating someone to a pulp, it just nauseates you. Well, think about that as a nation doing that to a people. It's just beyond. Well, we are out of time. Are there any other questions? But one other thing here. In verse 7, and the angel said to me, why do you wonder? I shall tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast and so forth. What is a mystery? I'm going to tell you about the mystery. Is that something you cannot understand?
Something previously hidden.
Okay, something previously hidden. And by the way, the word revelation, guess what that means? It means double covered. And so the picture is, here's something covered. That's a mystery. You don't know what it is until it's revealed. It's uncovered. And so a mystery is covered up. I'm going to reveal this to you, the book of Revelation. You want to know what's going on here? This book's telling you. Well, God bless. We're out of time, and I'll let Carl pick up and put the pieces back together and paint the picture. You've done a great job. Thank you for your input, and hope it's been beneficial to you. And I hope it's encouraging to you because you stay in Christ. You walk with him wherever the Lamb leads, and you will win. God bless. Thank you.